Hello and welcome to Prospect Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world. Thinking back on the Hagerstown Suns during Christmas, it is me, Jordan Schusterman. I am joined by Mike Farron. Jake Mintz is not with us, but he has better things to do. We are here, Mike Farron. We are recording this the day after Christmas. How are you doing?
I'm good, and I am a grateful one that you have a Hagerstown Suns cap on. And two, that before we started recording, we could reminisce about some of our times enjoying games in Hagerstown, which I would say is probably not an affiliated ball, in part because of the facilities.
Maybe, perhaps. But I am wearing a new Hagerstown Suns hat. I guess it's not technically new, but it is new for me, courtesy of my brother-in-law. A wonderful Christmas gift for me. But Mike, it's time to talk about prospects. It's Wednesday. We are still, as we move past Christmas, we are probably going to get some more action. I know we've had some moves over the last few days. We're going to talk about Kevin Kiermaier and Mitch Garver later on in the week. I believe Jake will be joining us from his, I don't know where he's staying, over on the other side of the world in Australia. But we'll hopefully have Jake back on later this week. But this is still Prospect Barbacast, and we have some prospect topics to get into that I'm excited to dig into with you, Mike. We're going to talk about a little bit more about Yamamoto, not just the fact that he's short, though I guess it might come up again to some degree, comparing him to Paul Skeens and how we talk about international free agents in relation to prospect lists. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to dig into the Dylan Cease trade rumors and all of the various different versions of trades that many of us are spending time crafting as we anticipate a deal with the White Sox at some point in the coming weeks, months, who's to say. So we're going to get into all that. But Mike, first of all, good Christmas. You chilling? All is well in Arizona?
Yeah, it was a nice, largely quiet Christmas. My in-laws came over for dinner. I was FaceTimed with my family back in Chicago, which is where all the nieces and nephews were celebrating. So that was great. We have a much busier New Year's coming up. We're going to have a house full of people starting on, let's see, this comes out on Wednesday. So tomorrow we're going to have, like half a dozen people coming, and that's going to be a lot of fun. How was yours?
Oh, it was great. As I mentioned, not only did I get a Hagerstown Suns hat, I had a wonderful time with my wife's family here in rural Ohio, where it is, I got to say, we went on a walk today, only like 50, 54 degrees. Last year, this time, it was negative 10. So wow. So this is basically in Phoenix is what I'm telling you.
It's like 63 really here today. So like you're not that far off. Yeah.
All right. Well, how about that? All right. Well, but I do anticipate that we are going to have a good amount of news coming. I'll probably mention this again on Friday's show, but I was looking, comparing the MLB trade rumors, you know, free agent list at this time last year and this time, you know, this year. And last year, nearly 40 of the top 50 had signed before New Year's. And this year, we're not even at half. So we're going to get a lot of action, free agency trades and whatnot. But hey, that's not what we're here to talk about too specifically. Because these topics go beyond. These go a little bit bigger picture. And I wanted to dig in a little bit more on this Yamamoto topic that kind of percolated on this year internet over the last few days, specifically how we talk about him in relation to prospects. And this came up in a few different ways. The first of which was, I think, an interesting kind of decision made by Baseball America. This is a publication that, of course, we follow. We'll follow all these sites, but BA has historically ranked international free agents and prospects, even if they're, you know, in their late 20s, as prospects on top 100 lists, because they are considered rookie eligible players. And so in that sense, it makes some amount of sense to compare them to other players who have not yet played in the major leagues as prospects. And BA announced this year they're not going to be doing that anymore, for a couple of reasons we can get into. And then the other interesting thing that kind of sparked some discussion online was an inbox question that was answered by our friends over at MLB Pipeline, Jonathan Mayo and Jim Callis, about where Yoshinobu Yamamoto would rank if MLB Pipeline was ranking him in the top 100. And after Yamamoto signed the largest deal ever given to a pitcher in free agency, the answer from both Callis and Mayo that he would not be number one, or even, you know, the number one pitcher necessarily, I think caught a lot of people by surprise, and I thought was ripe for a discussion here on this podcast, because there's a lot of different directions we could kind of go with this. So let's start with the first chunk. How have you historically viewed the concept of ranking international players alongside, you know, real prospects.
It's a little wonky, right? Because the level of competition that you're playing, especially now, and I think it's improved really in the last 15 years, and specifically in NPB, the Nippon Professional Baseball League in Japan, is probably a higher level all told to than AAA is, although it's likely close. So I don't really have an issue with it, and never did have an issue with it, in part because, you know, by rule, these players are rookies, right? This is, you would have the same thing in, you know, let's use college sports as an example, right? You have, often they're called like newcomer of the year, but if you had a transfer that came into a Power Five conference in whatever sport, and that was an award that was given out, it wouldn't matter if they'd played 2 or 3 years at another school at the same level, they're still considered the newcomer there. I think that's kind of similar here, although the level of play I don't think is the same as Major League Baseball. So I never really had an issue with it. At the same time, in a lot of the cases of the players that we've seen that have come specifically from NPB, they have been professionals in the highest league in their country for 7, 8, sometimes if they've come as true free agents, 9 years. And that's because NPB free agency is after 9 seasons. And that's a significant difference, right? You've played at the highest level in your country. You've dominated for a number of seasons. There was no place to go other than Major League Baseball. And you're kind of trapped by that. You have to, unless you are a true free agent, you've got to be posted by your club. Your club has to be willing to do that. So it doesn't matter to me either way. Like, there have been some interesting rankings over the years with international players. You know, I think, but what Pipeline ranked Shohei Ohtani number one a few years ago because he still was technically came over in that we were texting about this earlier, as an international amateur because of his age, even though he'd played professionally at the highest level. I didn't have a problem when Matt Suzaka was ranked and when Darvish was ranked or Tanaka was ranked. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if BA wants to change it, I certainly have no problem with it because you are theoretically talking about somebody that's a little bit more polished. I will say this, in Yamamoto's case, you're talking about a guy who's not that much older than some of the top prospects, right? He's only 25. Mm-hmm. And so that's a little bit, at least in terms of age, he lines up better, even though the experience is significant. And, you know, in the case of Yamamoto, you're talking about a guy that's won the Japanese version of the Cy Young Award 3 times. Like, he's basically, right, like he's basically Clayton Kershaw as an undersized right-handed pitcher in Japan.
Yeah. And this is where I struggle with kind of gauging it, especially in Yamamoto's case, where he is not that much older. I think I mentioned how Sam Dykstra of MILB.com, you know, pointing out that he's born the same year as you know, Landon Knack and mm-hmm. some of these other Dodgers pitchers that he's going to be, I mean, obviously not competing with, but in the rotation with, you know, Frasso and Gavin Stone, right? He's right in their age. But when we mention the level of competition, I think that's really important, but also still really hard to kind of grapple with, because as we move this discussion towards a comparison of Yamamoto and Skeens, this is where we start talking about, okay, so now we're comparing the SEC and, you know, even if you take it to the end of his time at LSU, which was in the College World Series facing teams like Tennessee and then Wake Forest, right? But whatever, this is 2 starts. But let's just say the SEC, we're still talking about 90-ish innings, 80-ish innings in the SEC mm-hmm. of a one. So again, the most simple way to look at it, Paul Skeens at LSU, and I know he had, of course, a good 2 years at Air Force. Let's focus on Paul Skeens at LSU, one of the greatest pitching prospects we've ever seen. It's 100, you know, in 22 innings, of 1.69 ERA, okay, in Division I at the high, which you could say is the highest level of Division I baseball. And then you have Yamamoto, who has essentially an identical ERA in 1,000 innings, okay, right, in NPB. And so at what point do you start to, and then there's a few different ways you can sort of logically work your way through it. You could say, and this was some of the arguments I saw online before we get to where Callison Mayo kind of slotted them and where we would kind of think about it, is, okay, before we get to what Paul Skeens would get on the open market, could we conceive that Paul Skeens, who is 4 years younger than Yamamoto, if he goes to NPB right now, could put up the same numbers that Yamamoto did over the next 4 years? Maybe, but like, it's hard for me to imagine that, you know, like that's really hard for me to think about. And so then where does this lead us? Because this is what makes this conversation so challenging. It is clearly not apples and oranges and why it is so hard to put them on the same list. But if we try and force ourselves to, where do you kind of land or lean, I would say.
So let me defend mayo and callus just a little bit in this, in that. Yeah. If you're talking about a pitcher like Yamamoto, who is pretty polished and is largely a finished product, and let's say you have him rated, you know, we haven't really had a discussion about the 2080 scale, but let's say we have him as what's considered a plus player, right? A player who would be, a 60 on the scouting scale, or a B1 on the ABC scale, or a first division starter, basically a number like a top half of number three starters or better in Major League Baseball. That tends to rate as a 60, and that feels like a pretty safe grade on Yamamoto based on all of the information that we have on him, the way we've seen him compete internationally. Maybe it's even a little bit better. We won't know until he faces this level of competition. But with Skeens, I think there is still a little bit of mystique because there's a feeling that he is not polished, and so there is more upside to him, right? And so you could see him being considered a 70 or an A2, which is more into that like back of the number one starters or top part of number two starters in the way that they're analyzed. And we're not talking about on each team. We're talking globally. There's only ever like 5 to 7 number one starters at any given time, right, across Major League Baseball. But we're talking about one of the best, you know, 15, let's say, pitchers or 20 pitchers in the game. And I think that there's that perception with Skeens. So defend him on that. That's I think, probably part of, without knowing for sure, part of why you would do that and go, okay, well, I would put him behind Skeens, but ahead of some of these other guys. Yeah. Realistically, though, what we're not looking at with that discussion is the risk and the polish, right? Because on a prospect list, you're really looking at upside as much as anything. And Skeens, who is a pretty safe bet to be a big league starter and probably a pretty good one, isn't as polished as Yamamoto is right now. I mean, the feeling is Yamamoto is going to step right into a rotation and basically, like, what's the downside for Yamamoto? He's Hiroki Kuroda, you know, like, and I'm going to use Japanese players just as an example because that's the competition that they've had, right? Like, if you go back and look at Hiroki Kuroda's career, like, that guy was a really damn good starter for like 7-8 years. He was Masahiro Tanaka, right? Yeah. Like, it's very similar in that regard. And so that's kind of what the floor is with Yamamoto, and clearly the Dodgers think that there's more upside to it. And because he's 25, they feel like there's going to be more to get. And so, like, if you're looking for which player is going to help a team the most in 2024, without a doubt, Yamamoto is that guy. But if you're to take the entirety of their career and what their ceiling is, I think it gets a little bit more mushy. That said, I think you're probably better off taking the sure bet than the guy that you're hoping gets to that point. And that's a whole other discussion on Skeens too.
Totally. And I think that that's what makes it hard when we want to start jumping to, oh, you think Skeens would get more than 300 and whatever million dollars on the open market. And it's hard because we just don't have a data point for the highest level talent at age 21 being on the open market. It's just not something we have in baseball. We don't have that, right? And so even though Yamamoto being so young, and I think that the number that we ended up at with Yamamoto was the product of an extreme set of circumstances that is both how good and accomplished he is and how talented he is and how safe he is and how proven he is, and the bidding, the teams in play that were bidding for him, right? That is what drove him up to, that's the thing, like, do I believe he is a true talent, $375 million player? I don't think so. And I think Yamamoto is awesome, right? And so where Skeens' true talent is and what teams would be willing to pay in the open market, we have no idea. There's no way for us to really know that. But to your point, you thinking about the ceiling and you're thinking about upside, like, especially with pitching prospects, sure, we heard the refrain commonly during Skeens' draft, you're best in Strasburg, best in Strasburg, best in Strasburg. And yeah, Strasburg did, in a lot of ways, completely live up to it. And we know how many bumps were along the way of that journey, let alone where it, of course, ended up on the back half of his career. But I think about another Pirates number one overall pick like Gerrit Cole, right? Gerrit Cole was another guy who was as safe as it gets and was a very good pitcher for quite a while. And then suddenly he was the best pitcher or one of the five best pitchers, right? And it took a while, right? It took a little bit. And so with Skeens too, I think that's kind of the thing that you're thinking about. But it is just so, so, so hard to compare these twos for all these reasons, not just the competition, the age and all these things. And it's a fun exercise, but because we don't have the data point for what players at that stage of their careers are worth on the open market, and this is where you get into this conversation of why the draft is just a ridiculous, you know, value, unbelievable value for teams beyond anything that we ever are willing to admit. That's why it's really an unfair discussion to even attempt to answer.
I think it's pretty safe, and I have not asked teams about this, but I would guess that if Paul Skeens had been a free agent at this age, coming off the season that he did at LSU, that he probably would have been in line for a deal that started with a two. It would have been a $200 million-plus dollar deal based on his upside.
I think that's a fair assumption.
Now, that said, he may not have been the highest paid guy coming out of last year's draft, because I think the position players tend to skew a little bit higher in that. And so Cruz and Langford and maybe even Walker Jenkins, probably, who was the fifth overall pick by the Twins, would have been ahead of him on that list.
Yeah, which is the last part of this discussion that I definitely wanted to hit on, because back to the reference that Callis made in his answer about how he didn't feel comfortable, you know, putting him ahead of a guy like Wyatt Langford or some of these that are Dylan Cruz, right? Some of these other hitters at the top, let alone Jackson Holliday. And it's also interesting because what's another data point that we sort of have, although it's a little misleading, Jackson Churio just signed an extension before he played a game. Now that's different because the leverage there is different. And what have you proven and how old are you? And he's not, you know, obviously he's not able to negotiate with the other 29 teams. He's just negotiating with the Brewers. But it is an interesting data point of like, okay, what are teams willing to pay players that have barely proven it at the major league level? You sort of see that with some of the hitters, what the Mariners were committing to Julio, what the D-backs were committing to Corbin Carroll. All of
what
that
the Rays
said,
did to Wander Franco.
What the Rays did with Wander Franco, right? All of that said, now none of those numbers came close to three. I guess the Julio contract technically sort of got 300 plus, but not really, right? With a lot of incentives involved. The reason I bring that up is, okay, Skeens aside, okay, we've said like the pitching prospects in general and projecting the risk, even of someone this good, how would you compare? Like, do you consider more valuable than Jackson Holliday? Like, that's the one where it is probably hard to imagine. Like, what does Jackson Holliday get on the open market right now? You know, that's the real question.
Yeah, I mean, I think there tends to be, like, I will admit that this is one of my biases, but I don't think I'm alone in this, in that you tend to value the position player more heavily than you do the pitcher. And that has nothing to do with the importance of pitching, right? We've all been raised on pitching and defense are what win you championships, right? And I don't think that that's entirely wrong. I think what it is that everything is a risk assessment, right? And the risk on pitching is always going to be greater by the nature of pitching. Like, God, pitchers get hurt at a higher rate than position players do. And so that's where some of it comes in. And that's part of, I think, the reading on, you know, people that may have had Dylan Cruz or Wyatt Langford ranked ahead of Skeens on draft night, is that that's something that had to factor into the discussion. Mm-hmm. So I think you're right. Like, if you're talking about putting Yamamoto on a prospect list, he probably doesn't go ahead of the very, like, the elite position player prospect. But, you know, like, if I pull up, and Pipeline hasn't updated theirs since the end of, it's like towards the end of the season, right? So, like, but let's just use them as an example. Mm-hmm. Like, Skeens is the third best prospect in baseball, right? They have Skeens ahead of Cruz, I think, in part because they had him ranked slightly ahead of Cruz. If you're to look at that list right now, I think Yamamoto probably is the second or third best player, right? I think there is downside risk with Jackson Churio, who's number two because of his youth. Youth works in his favor, but it also can work against him. But Yamamoto probably factors in there. It's just that, like, if you told me that in 10 years, the guy that had the better major league career was Skeens, I don't think I would bat an eye at that, right? Even though I think there are some things with Paul Skeens that are, you know, at least give you pause, right? Like, that's the one of the things that didn't get talked about enough. And I actually just talked about this last week on Power Alley. We were talking a little bit about Skeens, and you know, the data on his fastball coming out of the draft was not particularly good for a guy who throws 100 miles an hour. And when I say that, is a lot of the information that we get now in terms of how technology has changed the way player evaluations look is that we have an idea of what characteristics a fastball has that have success, right? They either have a ton of ride or come from a lower arm slot and play high at the top of the zone. They have a ton of horizontal movement or sink on it. And Skeens, for a guy that throws 102, doesn't get as much ride as you want, and he doesn't get as much run to the arm side. His fastball doesn't move as much as you would want. Now, are there adjustments that he can make? Sure. Now, to me, his best pitch is still his changeup. It's not even this sweeper that he learned last year, that sweeping slider at LSU. That was a pitch that he got a pretty good feel for relatively quickly. By about the third week of the season, it worked pretty well for Paul Skeens. But it's a little different facing pro hitters. And also, like, as much as this has been talked about with Yamamoto, it doesn't get talked about with college pitchers ever. The ball in professional baseball is different than the ball in college, too. And so Skeens is trying to make those adjustments. Now, the makeup on him is crazy. Like, when we talk about makeup, it's a combination between character and work ethic. And both those things are off the charts. Like, he's the only sophomore in the history of the Air Force Academy that has been named a captain. And, like, that should, like, tell you a little bit about him as a person. And I think Paul Skeens is going to make an incredible amount of adjustments. But in terms of the polish rate at this moment, he's not Yamamoto. And that's where fine. I think a lot of the pushback on what was said on that and on their podcast last week was because of that.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally fair. And yeah, but it is interesting, again, when you're, how much data are you working with, right? It's easy to look at the watch clips of Paul Skeens and be like, what do you mean? His fastball looks great. It's like, okay, well, Western Michigan, it's a little bit different than the Cubs. So there's, like, the fastball, especially against some levels of college competition, is going to work no matter how it's shaped. And at the same time, the starts where he did get touched up a little bit was because the fastball was getting hit. And, you know, you even see in the SEC some of the top levels, some of the best hitters at those levels, guys who won't even necessarily go on to become big leaguers are going to time that up. So all of it is fascinating, and how, where he kind of fits in, how aggressive the Pirates are going to be with him, let alone, like, to be honest, like, their track record of pitching and player development, which is not the most sterling at the moment, or at least not as long. Now listen. It's changed. Who's in charge there? Obviously, right? Shouts out John Baker, their new farm director, who I wholeheartedly believe in. But the other outside, kind of the pressures on Skeens and the timeline that he goes on and where he ends up failing and making those adjustments could be for the best for him. Could be challenging, right? And we're going to find that out in a very real way.
I mean, there is a real chance that Skeens' professional career mirrors Cole's a little bit, I think, who was their last number one overall pick as a pitcher. In that Cole's numbers were good in the minor leagues. They weren't exceptional. He wasn't Strasburg in the minors, but he never really got challenged. Strasburg never got challenged. And there is the chance that the first time that Paul Skeens really has to deal with failure is at the big league level. And, like, that's a good thing for a prospect to deal with failure, right? Yeah. Because that's where you learn how to get better. The problem when it happens at the big league level is that all of a sudden the spotlight's on you, and somebody is going to be waiting to scream bust at the top of their lungs if he goes out and has a 7 ERA in his first four starts. I mean, hell, former Pirate Charlie Morton's a great example of that. Go look at Charlie Morton's early career with the Braves. It was no bueno, right? Yeah. When he got traded to Pittsburgh in the Nate McLouth deal, people were like, he was still a prospect, but everybody's like, this guy has never had any success at the big league level, and he's put together a hell of a career. It's just that once you have to learn how to make those adjustments, whether it's to your pitch shape, to your pitch mix, to where you stand on the rubber, any number of different things, in mentality, whatever it is, you don't know until you get pressed. And we don't know when that's going to happen with Paul Skeens, because we haven't, quite frankly, seen him enough in pro ball to have an understanding yet.
No, not even close. And I will say, though, and am I biased because I was in the building and it's one of my strongest baseball memories, there's one Steven Strasburg, at least as far as my generation goes. I understand we had
That was sick.
I understand there were other
the opening night too.
Yeah, I understand that there have been other pitching debuts, rookie sensations earlier this century that stuff wise, you know, lived up to it in some respects. But when you kept hearing the same refrain, since Strasburg, okay, great. So now we're expecting Skeens to show up in May 2024 and, you know, strike out 13. Like, I'm just not expecting that of literally any starting pitcher at all. I'm not expecting it of Yamamoto. I'm not expecting it of whoever the next, you know, guy, we've seen the guys at the top recently with Grayson Rodriguez and blah, 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 right? So it's really hard. But the reason why you still end up picking Skeens one is because it is harder to find that dude at the very, very, very top of the pitching, you know, hierarchy than it is the awesome. I mean, in some respects, this is a much larger conversation, but I feel like that's what teams are chasing. If anything, it feels more rare.
Yeah. I think that that's kind of the traditional feel on it, but I would push back that pitching comes from lots of different places.
That's
generally
for sure.
Speaking, the star position players are the ones that come from the top of the draft.
Yeah, no, I know, which is maybe why it's a foolish thing to do, but that's fine. That's fine. We are hoping that of course we want to see all these players succeed, and Skeens from a work ethic standpoint too. That's also what you're buying into. You're buying into that to how much better he got, you know, even in his year at LSU. You're going to hope that kind of trajectory continues on in pro ball. So yeah, a lot of elements to the Yamamoto versus Skeens. I did find that really interesting. So thanks for going down that road with me, Mike. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we're going to talk about Dylan Cease, who talk about untraditional paths to where they currently sit on the you know, pitcher power rankings. Dylan Cease is a great example of that, so maybe we can get into that. We're going to take a quick break here on Prospect Barbercast. We'll be right back with my good friend, Mike Farrell.
Hey, everyone. Producer Chris here with a brand new housekeeping note about our merch. Basically, we have a bunch of new stuff. So if you've been looking for a Baseball Barbercast themed beanie or bucket hat, or even a t-shirt with one of those cool pockets on the chest, well, you can stop looking and start buying, because they are all available right now, just in time for winter. Just go to podswag.com/baseball and don't leave yourself clothesless this winter. That's podswag.com/baseball.
And welcome back to Prospect Barbercast. Jordan Schusterman joined by Mike Farron. Jake Mintz not with us on this episode. Hopefully you don't miss him too much. And hopefully he doesn't miss this upcoming conversation about one Dylan Cease, which may involve Jake's beloved Baltimore Orioles. But Mr. Farron, I know we wanted to talk about this because we got a little bit of reporting before Christmas about kind of the latest in the Dylan Cease trade discussions. Of course, with Yamamoto finally signing, we can anticipate that the starting pitching market will continue to move, both at the top with the likes of Snell and Montgomery, maybe Giolito, Stroman, Imanaga. But the trade market, even after Glasnow, is still very busy, and Cease appears to be the one that I think, from the purposes of our conversations on this episode of Prospect Barbercast, will likely involve the most prospects in the case that he is indeed dealt, or at least players who are, you know, earlier on in their careers. And I think that the reporting that we've gotten so far and the kinds of asks that the White Sox are making in this case, I think are instructive and interesting as we move forward into the way that we talk about, you know, trades and try and project trades. I've said oftentimes on this show that trades are always more fun, because no matter how much time you spend trying to put packages together, you will not figure out what's actually getting put on the table. Like, oftentimes there's some element of the trade, or there's some team involved, or there's some prospect that you're just not thinking of, and these teams get really creative, and there's guys that teams value in totally different ways than what you see on the public side of things, and that certainly impacts what these packages look like. So I'll throw it to you before we start getting into some specific teams. What's your kind of read on Dylan Cease's value in general?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is one of those things that it's worth taking a little bit of a step back and looking at Cease over the last couple of seasons to get a true understanding of where teams view him. So he's 2 years away from free agency. Last year was a disappointing season from a results standpoint for Cease. The year before was significantly better. I mean, he was, what, fourth in the Cy Young Award, I think, in 2022.
Second
in the Cy Young Award.
Yeah.
He had a terrific year, high strikeout rate. His walks have always been an issue for him, but they were more under control. Last year, the strikeout rate dropped a little bit. The walks were a little bit higher. But if you were to look at some of the nerd numbers, as I like to call them, like fielding independent pitching, which is an ERA predictor that uses strikeouts, walks, and home runs allowed to kind of guess what future ERA is going to be. And it's better than the current year ERA for predicting the future. Cease's numbers were much more in line. His peripherals were much more in line with what he did the year before. So that's part of the reason why he's still valued so highly, even though he's coming off a year where what was his ERA was near five, right? So, so I think it's a little bit like the Zach Wheeler situation a few years ago with the Phillies when, you know, he was a free agent and people were saying, well, Wheeler hasn't really done much. And you looked at the data and you were like, this looks pretty good. And now Wheeler's gone on to be an absolute monster for the Phillies and one of the handful of the best pitchers in the game. So I think that's where the industry views Cease. The other part of this is that, and this is the part, I'm actually kind of curious your take on this too, because we've already gone through some of my biases on when it comes to prospecting. Another big part is like, what do the White Sox want and need? Because the White Sox have been historically thin, at least in terms of their farm system. And even if you go back to when they had the number one system overall, if they went through that rebuild and what after 2016, it was a very top-heavy system. It lacked depth, and specifically it lacked position player depth. They had some guys that really hit in that group, and then they had some ones that didn't. And the problem with not having a ton of really good prospects is that when you need to fill from within, if you don't have viable options in the upper minors, then you have to go outside the organization, and there, for most owners, there is a finite number of dollars that you're willing, that they're willing to spend, right? So that's been a big issue for the White Sox organization, and I think that's part of what we have to talk about with Cease is like, what are the White Sox actually targeting in a trade, and what should they be targeting in a trade? Because that may help to explain some of what the value lies and how, like, should they be going for ceiling or should they be going for depth, I think are really important discussion points.
Yeah. I mean, the basic place to start is, okay, why are they doing this? Why are they trading Cease to begin with? Well, because their roster was bad, got worse because they traded a lot of talent away and now projects to, even in the AL Central, be really, really rough, especially if they make even some more moves, which is why the general reporting we've heard is anyone that's not Luis Robert, who I would have to assume when you look at his contract and extension from a trade value standpoint is probably like top 5 or 10 in baseball at this point in terms of just best contracts and projecting forward. So if we assume
almost
Luis
untradeable,
Robert,
it's so good.
Yeah,
like, untradeable. That's the problem. Yeah, so, you can't get fair return.
Exactly. So, but beyond Robert, like, they're open for business and Cease is their biggest chip left. And that's where I think, again, this gets into not motivation, but also just kind of the principle of like, what kind of trade are we trying to build? Are we shooting for the moon? Are we trying to get a foundational piece, or are we trying to fill out this roster? Because while they did seem to target pitching a lot in some of the trades that they've made, we saw them target pitching in the Rule 5 draft. They're good, you know, continuing to do that. This position player group, even if you acknowledge Colson Montgomery, who we've talked about on the show, what I'm looking at this core and I'm saying, who's really on this next good White Sox team on offense? You know, some of these are big names in Moncada and Vaughn, but not necessarily Eloy, right? Not necessarily ones that I'm like, hell yeah, like they're definitely in the lineup in 2026 at this point. That's just, I mean, maybe I don't know where you're at on some of those guys in particular, but to that point, that's why I kind of think, man, this team needs everything. This team needs to be going in any direction possible. But to your point, and we can start, you know, looking at some of the teams, you know, reportedly involved. Different teams can offer very different things. You know, if they want to try and build out some more foundational offensive pieces, you're going to look at a team like Cincinnati. You're going to look at a team like Baltimore, right? Mm-hmm. If you're looking for even more pitching, who they already got some from, you know, at the deadline, you're probably going back to the Dodgers or honestly Atlanta. You know, Atlanta's farm is about as thin as it gets, but they at least still have some arms that you could conceive of being appealing to a team at the stage of the rebuild that the White Sox are in. So I don't know. I know the Cubs are another team that had come up. The Cardinals earlier in the offseason seemed like another team that has a lot of offensive, you know, firepower that they could essentially move potentially, but they don't seem to be as much in the mix. Is there one team that stands out that you would want to start with? I know the Reds are one team that we heard the most recent kind of reporting about who was reportedly involved in the White Sox asks. I think it's also important to remember as we get into some of these Reds names, obviously, if you're Chris Getz, certainly early in the offseason, you should absolutely be asking for, you know, four top 100 prospects. Like, well, that's how the same reason Scott Boras is starting with his Cody Bellinger ask at $300 million, right? Whatever. Like, mm-hmm. That's how you're going to probably start when you have someone that you view as very attractive. So Which team would you want to kind of start with in terms of who could make sense as a partner?
I mean, I think the Reds make about as much sense as anybody, right? So I think it's good. And the reporting that we had over the weekend from both Bruce Levine, the Score in Chicago, and Jason Williams in Cincinnati, Inquirer, they kind of painted a similar picture, right? At least two, if not three, starting pitching prospects and a position player. And that's, you know, that's a tough ask. Like, if you're to look at players who get dealt in the winter, there's not maybe the same level of desperation for starting pitching in the winter that there is at the deadline. At the deadline, somebody desperately needs somebody, they're going to make the trade, right? In the winter, the benefit you have is that you have more suitors that you can theoretically push off one another, but you don't necessarily have the one that's willing to, that's feeling the pressure enough that they have to go all in and give you this incredible package of return. Now, that said, like, the names that we heard for the most part linked to the Reds were pitching, and the Reds' real depth at their major league level is young, controllable position players. And that's the, to me, one of the major leads that the White Sox have. The White Sox have two very good prospects. You mentioned Colson Montgomery. Brian Ramos is the other one. I think there's a little bit more question about Ramos because of some approach issues. He's a third baseman. He's probably going to end up taking over from Mankata when Mankata's a free agent after this year. I think Mankata has an option for next year, but the way he's performed the last couple seasons, it seems unlikely that it would be exercised. And so what you need is you need players who have an impact, I think, on your major league roster. They've been one of the worst offensive teams in the league the last 2 years, and they're not going to get any better anytime soon with the group that they have. Now, that said, they also have brought in a new, you know, head of pitching, and Brian Bannister had been with the Giants and been with the Red Sox before that, and Banny has a really great reputation. Full disclosure, I've known Banny for a long time. We know each other really well. I think very highly of him. But I also would like to see what he does with some of the arms that they have in the organization. And I think trying to find a way to add impact offense makes the most sense. So the Reds, the Orioles, and the Dodgers would be my focuses in a trade talk. Now, the question is that Chris Getz's? Because to your point, the deals that he's made so far, with the exception of getting like Nicky Lopez, have been focused way more on pitching. And we know that you have to acquire a lot of pitching to get enough guys that actually make it at the big league level because of attrition and injury.
Yeah. Which, and again, I think Cease in particular is just such a fascinating, you know, case study in terms of the kind of pitcher that he was as a prospect and what he's kind of become. And I think he laid out a good understanding of where his value is across the league. I think too, if I'm the Reds, you know, I'm, of course, you see some of these names being floated in the package. Rhett Lauder, you know, they just took him in the top 10. Chase Petty, who they had acquired in a trade from Minnesota, who's really taken big strides. You know, Connor Phillips, who made his major league debut. Like, the Reds have had a lot of success, you know, I would say on both sides, but they're still trying to find. Of course, they had a lot of health issues in the rotation last year, which is really what ultimately sunk them in the wild card race. But man, I mean, Cease, the other thing about him is, and I don't know if you view this as a good or a bad thing, dude has been unbelievably durable. For someone of his profile, he has not missed a start in 4+ years. And you could say, okay, that's why he's about to blow, right? If you want to be real cynical and you say, all right, well, this guy's throwing, you know, all these sliders and throwing 98 and blah, 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 like that makes him more risky, whatever. You could also say, hey, durability is what you're going to bet on if you want future durability in a lot of respects. I bring that up just to say, if you're the Reds and if you're some of these other teams who are in position, what is the kind of deal that you're even more comfortable making for a guy like Cease? I don't know. Like, you do look at the depth of the infield, names that we're trying to figure out. Okay, and they just signed Candelario, right? We know the Reds are trying to win in 2024. That sparked a lot of conversations about, okay, well, does a Jonathan India trade make more sense? Now, Jonathan India obviously makes zero sense for the White Sox, but if you look younger at somebody like Noel V. Marte, even a guy like Encarnacion Strand, who, you know, he's a much more risky, more limited prospect, but at least someone who has proven it at every level of the minor leagues and has, you know, 5-6 years of control, a bat that you could build around. Now, that's not exactly a profile that I think the White Sox necessarily want to lean as heavy into, considering the kinds of players that they've had a lot of struggles with in recent years, where it's very limited defensively. Marte is someone that I think could make a lot more sense. I think when you look at the Orioles and Dodgers, I'm fascinated when we do think about the Orioles. We've been waiting to see when are they going to maybe flip some of this depth on offense. It's just hard for me to figure out who is that young hitter that they would be willing to move. I mean, they've been so reluctant to make any. I mean, we've even saw the slightest bit when they traded Darryl Hernández to Oakland for Cole Irvin. And he's Hernández looks like he's actually could be a pretty good player. But it's really hard for me to sort through all of these guys in the upper minors for Baltimore. We moved Jackson Holliday to the side, but between Kerstad and Norby and Westberg and, you know, all these guys that, like, I don't even really know who has the most value, and it's hard to know which of those would make sense as a centerpiece. Because that's what I'm thinking about with the Cease discussions. Who is the best player they could get? It is going to be more than one player, but who is, what is the kind of ceiling for what they could be going for here?
Yeah, I think you're trying to get, and I would add like Mayo and Ortiz or two others in the Orioles system.
Yeah,
right? Like
you're always going to forget
Colton
one.
Cowser's another one who may be blocked a little bit in the outfield. Like there's just a ton of talent there. I mean, to me, I think ideally you're acquiring the player that has the highest floor and ceiling that you can get, right? It's a guy that you feel like is going to be a regular and maybe can be more than that. And to me, acquiring a player that has a high ceiling gives you more room for, if he doesn't become a superstar, and can he be just a solid, and I use just in quotes, a solid regular, right? Can he be a contributor every day in the lineup? You know, some of that has to be, you have to mitigate what the risks are, right? If you've got a guy that has approach risks, I mean, we talked a lot about swing decisions last week, that's a guy that you're not necessarily trying to acquire because the risk reward is too great. If you've got guys that make good decisions, that they're able to know the difference between a strike and a ball, and that they make solid contact on pitches in the zone, like they're going to be tougher to acquire, but that also probably reduces the depth of the trade that you want. I'm always a fan of acquiring ceiling over depth. And this is going to give us our first real test on what Chris Getz wants to get. You know, I thought his trade with Aaron Bummer was really good in the sense that he got a couple of guys who could be starting pitchers. You know, you're buying really low on Mike Soroka. Jared Schuster probably pitches at the back of the White Sox rotation on a not-so-good team. They get a good defender in Nicky Lopez, right? Like, there's a lot of different things that went well in that deal for a guy who was, again, like Cease, the peripherals were way better for last year than what the actual numbers were. I think you're looking for a little bit more ceiling here because you do win with impact offensive players, and the White Sox need to add some to go with Robert and what they hope is Montgomery. And we should add Jefferson Caro in that as well. Or is it Edgar Caro? I'm sorry. Edgar Caro, the catcher that they got from the Angels, who once they put the real baseball back into play in the Southern League last year instead of the pre-tacked one, his numbers looked much more normal. So, like, you're trying to find guys that can fit with that, and you need a lot more position players. Also, they really need a right fielder. Like, Colton Cowser would be great. But he could play right field right away.
But this is the thing. Like, they need so much that, like, you are probably just looking for someone you believe could be a 65 one day, right? Or a 60, you know, and it has a 50 floor or something. And again, going through all of those Orioles guys, does one stand out to you as an Orioles headliner that you would feel most, you personally, Mike Farron, would feel most excited about? Because the challenge is that so few of them have actually played that much in the major leagues, but almost all of them have destroyed AAA. So I don't know. Again, like Kerstad was the top five pick. Hauser was a top pick, but there's like more concerns there. Mayo, you could argue, maybe has the biggest ceiling, but he's farther away, but he also reached AAA. So I don't know. And he obviously is a little bit more all along. I don't know where you view Mayo defensively, but again, the Orioles seem to be the team that is the most reluctant to deal these guys. So maybe we shouldn't be as focused on them as a possible suitor, but they also have the most of them. And so they still feel like the most sensible one. Whereas again, then if you go back to Cincinnati, think about a guy like Spencer Steer, who I don't think, again, he's never going to come across as the sexiest part of the deal, but like you just got a full season of him being a damn good major league hitter who can at least fake it at multiple positions. And I know his defensive advanced numbers were horrible, but like I watched a lot of Spencer this year. I think he's really good. And like that's a talk about safe. Talk about you know what you're getting there. Maybe there's a little bit more upside offensively. I just don't know, man. Like, that's where it's so tough, let alone like a Michael Bush type who's proven nothing at the major league level, but has also proven everything in AAA.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think those are the guys, though, that like, I don't think Steer is a guy that, that the Reds are going to deal. Like, I don't think that's the case. But when they acquired him, that's the kind of player that you're looking for, right?
Exactly.
You're looking for those position players that you feel like can help the major league team. And at least Steer is going to be like a 2-3 war player, right? Like,
yeah.
Which is a solid everyday left fielder. Like, you need guys like that, right? Yeah. Noelvi Marte. It's why I think Nick Kroll's work in the rebuild in Cincinnati was about as good as you can ask an executive to do, because he didn't say we need to add all of this pitching. They added pitching. They got really interesting guys. Brandon Williamson, Connor Phillips, whose name has come up in these trade discussions. Like, these are interesting arms for sure. But what they did was they targeted key position players in all these deals. Noelvi Marte, Spencer Steer, Christian Arroyo, whose name has also been linked to
Edwin.
To,
yeah, Edwin.
Edwin Arroyo. Excuse me, not Christian Arroyo. I'm in a, like, apparently I'm in like malapropo. It must be Christmas week. So like they screw up everybody's name today. But like all of those guys, they make sense, right? Like it's again, like you're getting something and somebody that can impact the big league level right away. The guy I think I would be targeting if I were them is Heston Kerstad with the Orioles.
Yep.
I have been a fan of his since he was an amateur. I think there is a chance that he is an impact corner bat. Maybe it's at first base, which isn't great for the White Sox because they have other more pronounced needs than a first baseman. But I think he's a guy that's going to hit in the middle of a lineup. And they really need somebody that can hit in the middle of the lineup. And if you get that with, you know, Luis Robert, and if they hold on to Eloy Jimenez, which is a possibility, like all of a sudden you're starting to look at a credible middle of the order. Like you have to get a little bit of bounce back from Andrew Vaughn, and you need to get, you know, probably more out of Yoan Moncada than you have for, to have any hopes of shocking the world in the Central. And I don't necessarily think that that's going to happen, but I think that there is a chance to build a good middle of the lineup core if you can acquire those guys. Now, that said, like all of these names that we heard that we're linked to, we've gone through this entire exercise, and what, 80% of the names that we heard linked to the White Sox were pitchers.
Yeah. Although, let's also remember that, sorry, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris Getz didn't run the deadline.
No, he did not.
They you know, finally canned Han and Kenny after they made all those trades, right? And so, now Getz was obviously a part of the organization, but that's another thing when we think about, okay, what are they targeting? What kinds of deals are they looking to do? You know, who knows? You know, that's the kinds, they added all those kinds of pitchers, but maybe, as you said, I think we're going to learn a lot about it. But I mean, you do kind of have to nail this in a lot of respect. I mean, listen, they're already going to be bad. We know the direction that they're going. In some sense, the pressure's off Chris Getz. But also, I mean, it's been really, really, this is, as you mentioned, back to 2017 and what it felt like the White Sox were building towards. They failed. They failed miserably, right? Got to the playoffs once, twice, didn't do much with it. And now it is a barren roster that has a couple things that you're holding on to,
yeah,
which is Luis Robert is one of the best players in the world, which is Colson Montgomery's, you know, a top 10, top five prospect. And then after that, man, you got a lot of building to do, and you got to hope that a lot of these guys that you just traded for and will continue to trade for are going to, you know, move in the right direction.
Yeah, but Colson Montgomery is not a sure bet either.
No,
like,
not at all.
And I really like Colson Montgomery, but like, listen, if you start looking at his gameplay total, you look at the strikeout rate, like in the minors, it hasn't been flawless. And
100%.
I think there's a feeling among White Sox fans that whatever they're doing is just, you know, like Paul DeJong is there to just, you know, to be there until Montgomery is ready, and then
Lopez,
hold his golf clubs.
And
that's the question. Like, the problem is that it may not happen this year, right?
Totally.
For him. I mean, his numbers in Birmingham in 167 plate appearances last year were, what, 244, 400, 428. That's pretty good overall. He had a 400 on base percentage.
Yeah.
But strikeouts are still a little bit high, and we're talking about a guy that hasn't played a full season of games yet.
I guess I totally agree. He's, to me, far from a sure thing. I just mean, from where we felt when he was taken 22nd overall to now is undeniably a massive success so far, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, first round Indiana high school kid to, like, late in
so
the first round.
So in that sense, that's been a win, but long way to go to knowing for sure that he's a foundational piece. But, man, you look at some of these other pieces, and you just there's just massive risk, and it's going to take a long way to go. And but again, if you hit on enough of them, in theory, in the Central, you know, you will maybe be able to get back into it sooner rather than later. All right. Again, we could talk these trades all day because I do think it is going to happen. And when it does finally happen, assuming it does, I guess they could hold on to it until the deadline. But assuming it does happen, we will certainly react to the return here on Prospect Barbercast. Before we say goodbye, Mike, I did want to hit on just another minor trade that we would not even sniff if this were a normal episode. But because it's just you and me, let's talk about Estevan Florial for 5 minutes. Listen.
Yeah.
And here's the other thing. If this same trade with these same talent level players with the same track record and it wasn't a Yankee, I'm not sure we would spend 5 minutes on it. But because Florial and Yankees, the way that Yankees prospects are talked about and the way that they are often thrown around in trade discussions because their value is often inflated beyond what it maybe actually is in the industry. Florial's a fascinating case, a guy who showed so many tools early in his career, despite not really being very well known when he signed as an amateur. Really interesting background. He actually signed originally under, there was some basically issues with his identity. He signed under a false identity. Mm-hmm. Eventually that got sorted out and it was made clear that he was born in the Dominican. His mother is Haitian. But basically once he made it through to the complex, through the complex league DSL in A-ball, he really took off. And he was just kind of the classic profile of, wow, like it looks really good, but he's going to strike out a lot. And is it going to sink the rest of the profile? The fact that he's swinging so often, even though his physical tools, the speed, the defense in center field, and then power that has really come on over the last couple of years in the upper minors. Ultimately, the Yankees never trusted him nearly enough to give him real run in the major leagues, to the point where Yankees fans were like, oh, well, we'll just put him as a headliner in some trade for some player, even though his value was never actually really there. But really interesting journey for him. Now he goes to Cleveland in exchange for Cody Morris. Seems like the Yankees trying to kind of backfill some of the innings that they've lost, as we've talked about in recent episodes and trades and Rule 5 draft and all that stuff. So do you have any thoughts on Florial and his ascent and now where he goes to Cleveland, where, I mean, this is, if you're not going to spend any money and you're Cleveland and you're looking for someone who can maybe hit the ball over the fence, I guess this is a gamble you're going to try and take.
Yeah, I mean, it's been nearly a decade, right, since a Cleveland outfielder hit 20 home runs in a season.
Yeah.
And Florial may not get there because he may not make enough contact. I mean, he's run a high strikeout rate.
Yep.
But he can play defense, and he can run. You know, in addition to the power that's come about the last two seasons, where I think it's, 43 homers, I think, over the last 2 years, he's also stolen, close to 65 bases in that time and not been caught very often. Like, he's got – there's power and speed – and defense. It's just there aren't that many guys, even ones who post good walk rates in the minors, who strike out 30% of the time at any level in the minor leagues and end up being successful. There is only one Javi Baez for a reason, right?
And eventually it was not pretty, right? So there are
Joey Gallo.
It's possible, but I just find this fit in particular interesting because the offensive bar he is in theory trying to clear and compete with is the bottom, which is Miles Straw.
Right.
And it is the opposite. It is zero power, 20 power, and put the ball in play and play great defense in center field. So that is an interesting contrast that will in theory be his competition in center field, because ultimately Cleveland, for a lot of the things that they've done well, they've traded away a lot of really good players on the offensive side. And you could say some of those they should have seen coming. You could say some of those were just total failures in terms of internal evaluation. We talked a lot about the Yankees, you know, being good at not trading away players that come back to bite them. Cleveland, I mean, my goodness, there is a really long list of those guys recently, from Nolan Jones and Will Benson. And now, of course, Junior Caminero is the one, you know, that's one that was at a lower level, but at a lot of levels that they have, you know, traded guys away. So to see them kind of take a flyer on someone else's, you know, failed prospect is kind of an interesting turn of events there. So it is a nice kind of landing spot for Florida.
And the Yankees get a guy who's a prospect too. I mean, Cody Morris is not nothing. He's got a good fastball cutter combination.
Yep.
He is kind of the pitcher version of Florial, and that he's got good stuff, but he can't throw strikes consistently, right? And so they get optionable minor league depth, and it's probably a better use of a 40-man spot for them than Florial was, who, you know, had been dropped from the 40-man roster in April and then added back in September. So it's, I think it's an interesting deal. I don't know that it's going to end up impacting either roster particularly.
Totally. But I do agree. When I looked at it, when I was looking at Morris, I was like, oh yeah, this is like the hitter version of Florial, except nobody knows who he is because his name's Cody Morris and he's right. from Cleveland. As opposed to Florial, who has like been, you know, just discussed and analyzed so hypercritically for the last 5 years as a Yankees prospect.
Well,
so.
Mike Bauman from Fangraphs knows who Cody Morris is because he pitched himself there a lot.
That's true. And which good. He reunited with Clark Schmidt, who he was teammates for a year. So there's a really good heartwarming holiday story there, Cody Morris and Clark Schmidt. I always wonder with those, it's like there have to be cases of teammates, college teammates reuniting where they just hate each other, right? Like that has to be a thing that happens all the time. And we just always assume like, oh, they were definitely, you know, roommates or they were homies. It's like, no. What if Clark Schmidt's like, oh, Cody Moore. God damn it. Like Cody.
Yeah.
I mean, I listen, to be clear, I know nothing about Cody Morris the person. So this is not anything about that. I just always find it funny that we assume that. So anyway.
Yeah. There are definitely some high profile cases of that in the past.
Yes. No, I well said. All right. Anyway, Mike Farron, this has been a delight. Thank you for joining me on this Boxing Day edition of Prospect Barbacast. We're recording this on Tuesday afternoon. We'll be back on Friday next week. Prospect Barbacast TBD, because we got some travel. We got some stuff up in the air, but we're going to keep doing our best to bring you this show. But thank you, Mike, as always, for joining me.
Thank you.
This was a pleasure.
Happy New Year.
This was great. Happy New Year to you. Hopefully your hospitality goes swimmingly over the new year. good luck with that.
Thanks.
Are you anything you're worried about, or is it going to be okay?
No, it's going to be great. Like it's like six of our closest friends, and including one of my brothers and his wife, and so
perfect.
It's going to be a lot of cooking and libations. So
all right.
It's going to be nice weather.
Fun times in the Farron household. But thank you, Mike, for joining me. Thank you to Isabella Joseph for producing. As always, you can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. And we'll be back later this week, hopefully with Jake Mintz. We'll see. Goodbye for now.
SiriusXM Podcasts.